So we turn everybody in the Old Testament section of the Bibles. Do help me, by the way, as I preach from this passage. It's a great help to me personally. If you've got the Bible open, reach for it. Page 606 in the Old Testament section. If you cannot help me, I cannot help you. We do this together. We make the sermon together. We all study it. Bible's open, every Bible open, page 606, and we're going to be looking at Isaiah for these minutes together. Isaiah chapter 8. Now, I don't know whether you have been finding this beneficial the last few Sundays, looking at these early chapters of Isaiah. Very rarely is it ever preached on. Go through old books of sermons by the great divines. Did they ever bother to preach on these early chapters of Isaiah 1 to 8? Hardly at all. I don't think I've ever heard a sermon on Isaiah 8. Certainly never seen one. Did anybody ever preach one? Is this the first sermon that's ever been preached on Isaiah 8? I don't know. It could be. Could be. We're going to look at it now. Let's explore it together. How well do you know it? Well, here we are. Isaiah 8, and I'm going to start, I think, at verses 3 and 4. Now, we didn't have this in the reading, partly because it was difficult to pronounce the name, but let's read it. And I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. Then the Lord said to me, call his name Meher Shalal Hashbaz, for before the child knows how to cry, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. So that, ladies and gentlemen, was the name of Isaiah's third son. Oh yes, it was his son, all right. The prophetess, mentioned in verse 3, the mother of the little boy, was Isaiah's wife. What does the name mean, you ask? Is there a meaning? Yes, there's a meaning. In the Middle East, there nearly always was a meaning. The Hebrew experts tell us that Meher Shalal Hashbaz means literally, speed up the plunder, hurry up with the loot. Well, that is an unusual name to give a little baby. I mean, of course, parents do sometimes like those added value names for their children. Sometimes, African friends here will know that they often like to do this in Africa. The late Bishop Festo Kivenjeri of Uganda, who preached here a number of times, was given the name Kaskina when he was a little tot, which simply meant little hiccup. When our family lived in Kenya years ago, a little Kikuyu boy was born prematurely in the back of our family car before the mother could be rushed to the maternity hospital. She decided to call him, well, I'll spell it for you, M-O-T-O-K-A, motor car. Is what he was called. Very apt, really. That young lad would always remember his origins. I learnt of one Ugandan family that gave their little boy a name they simply liked the sound of. It was Oxford University Press. It's lovely, really. And back in the 19th century, over here in the UK, when James Simpson, the discoverer of chloroform, tried out the new anaesthetic on a mother in labour, the woman was so delighted with the reduction in pain that she called her little baby girl Anaesthesia. Well, it makes sense in a way. But Meher Shalal Hashbaz, I mean, that takes the biscuit. It seems to be something of an... Was it an extra burden to lay upon a baby pitched into a stern, unrelenting world? You can imagine poor Mrs. Isaiah out with the pram. That's a nice little boy you've got. What's his name, dear? Oh, we're calling him Speed Up the Plunder, Hurry Up with the Loot. No, in Western society, that would be a surefire conversation stopper. Not so, I think, in the Middle East. Especially if the baby is the son of the top spokesman of the day, and very especially if it's 735 BC and you're part of Judah in the south, threatened by an invasion from the coalition forces of Israel in the north and Syria nearby, simply because your country hasn't joined the coalition to fight off the biggest superstar and super enemy of all, Assyria. And even more especially if your own king Ahaz has been fool enough in fighting off Israel and Syria to call for military assistance from all people, the Assyrians themselves. It was a dangerous moment. We were hearing about that in our last study. So the time seemed ripe for a bit of drama on the part of Isaiah. A visual aid in the form of his little baby. Give him a resounding name then, says God. And so, name this child, said the vicar. And out it came. Speed up the plunder, hurry up with the loot. Oh, says the vicar, a little more water, please, for that. Meher Shalal Hashbaz. Although Isaiah's own king, Ahaz, seemed bent on inviting the Assyrian war machine into his own backyard, and although the outlook seemed darker than ever, we don't find Isaiah recanting from his earlier stern warnings. Not even when the threats he prophesied against Syria and Israel in chapter 7 seem to be delayed. No, he intensifies the warnings in this chapter 8. He knows that God has revealed his will, and he knows that God has sent him. In chapter 8, the issues are even sharpened up then with the birth of this third son, as the prophet insists on the great biblical principle that we have to choose between God's way and our own. Again and again, the scriptures thrust upon us the choice we have to make between, basically, two ways. Here in this chapter, we're presented with what I may call a tale of two identities. Two identities crystallized in two individuals. One I've already named Isaiah's newborn son, Meher Shalal Hashbaz. Perhaps they called him something else within the confines of the close family circle. Nevertheless, his symbolical name stood for the grabbing, plunderous greed of an anti-God philosophy. Isaiah, in verses 1 and 2 here, have a look at it. He gives prominent publicity to the impending birth of this baby. Why, the name is to be placarded, not simply on a piece of papyrus to be passed around a group of erudite students, but on a large public signboard written, as verse 1 says, in common characters. That is to attract the attention of even the most careless passerby in Jerusalem. The substance of the prophecy is there at the end of verse 3 and into verse 4. Call his name Meher Shalal Hashbaz, for before the child knows how to cry, my father or my mother, that is, before he's 2 years old, the wealth of Damascus, that's referring to Syria, and the spoil of Samaria, referring to Israel, the two coalition forces, will be carried away before the king of Assyria. The identity symbolized by Meher Shalal Hashbaz will be stamped upon an entire people facing disaster. But I mentioned two identities. What's the other? Well, if you heard our last study, you remember the other birth of a baby prophesied in chapter 7 and verse 14. Behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, the interpretation being, God is with us. Emmanuel, with us, God. As we learned last week, there's an element of ambiguity in the text. It could be interpreted collectively, in that many mothers would call their children by that name in gratitude for God's deliverance of his people. But it can also be understood to refer to an individual baby boy whose birth would ensure the continuity of the dynasty of David, so vital to the Jewish people. That was the strength of the prophecy. The continuity of the messianic line, despite everything that would happen. Which, of course, the New Testament takes up in its ultimate application to the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. In Matthew 1 and verse 23. Emmanuel. The name figures again here in Isaiah 8. Twice, actually. Have a look. First at the end of verse 9, where the name is applied to the whole nation. And then secondly, at the end of verse 10, with the reassuring phrase, "For God is with us." The actual Hebrew reading, Emmanuel. So two individuals emerge. And which will you identify with? Comes the implied challenge of Isaiah. These important chapters are a tale of two identities. One or other of them, one or other, is going to characterize and dominate all of your living, says the prophet. Isaiah's message reaches out 27 centuries down the line to us now. It hasn't changed. We can choose. No, we have to choose. In every generation, between life with God, Emmanuel, and the grubby short-term deal that ends stripped of everything, Meher Shalal Hashbaz. Speed up the plunder. Hurry up with the loot. Nobody can escape that choice in the end. It centers here in this tale of two identities. And secondly, I see in these paragraphs a tale of two kingdoms. Two kingdoms visualized in the waters of two rivers. Look again at the Bible. Everybody, have a look. We read about them in verses 5 to 8. The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people have refused the waters of Shiloah, or Siloam, that flow gently and melt in fear before Rezin, the king of Syria, and the son of Remaliah, the military ruler of Israel, therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, capital letters, referring to Assyria's Euphrates. Mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah, it will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. It's a contrast here of two kingdoms. The gentle, peaceable kingdom of a God who rules with love, symbolized by the unspectacular flow of Judah's Shiloah, as against the grabbing, tyrannical power of a kingdom of materialism symbolized by the Euphrates in full flood, sweeping in from Assyria. When sometimes we look at the television screens of some dreadful flood, we've had some in Britain recently, or you look at even worse ones in Bangladesh, you're just horrified by what you see. Water cascading in, yes, often after a time of drought, much needed water, but too much. And as you look at the raging red torrent, you think no good will come out of this. It's destroying everything in its path. So with the kingdom that stands against God. Isaiah, by his words, implies that his listeners find the quiet waters of Siloam too unimpressive altogether to protect them from the Syrian-Israel coalition. Very well then, he says, it will be the torrential waters of another kingdom. And they will overwhelm you, O Emmanuel. Not, insists Isaiah, that the kingdoms of this world are stronger than God's kingdom. On the contrary, look again at the Bible, verse 9 and 10. Those kingdoms will come to grief themselves. It'll make no impression upon those who live under the banner of Emmanuel, because, look at the end of verse 10, God is with us. So which kingdom will you choose, people of Judah? Which river will you trust yourselves to? The biggest surprise of all these centuries is that anything as feeble looking as the kingdom of God and the church of Jesus Christ has survived, let alone become the one biggest world faith around. It centers in somebody born as a baby of a peasant mother, who died the most embarrassing and unmentionable of deaths, whose staff officers were a bunch of 11 Israeli tradesmen and civil servants, untrained. We shall be celebrating that death in a few minutes' time in the Holy Communion. And as we receive those emblems of bread and wine, we shall be saying ourselves in this church, I am choosing the gentle yet permanent kingdom. I'm opting for the waters of Shiloah. I am following Jesus Christ. We can't avoid a choice. It centers in a tale of two identities and two kingdoms. And, last bit, we're faced ultimately with a tale of two destinies. Just a glance at verses 11 to 22. You see, the choice is running through these sentences. Where are you heading? How are you going to end up? You see, verse 13, you can have the Lord of hosts as your mainstay and your focus of all that is holy, and, verse 14, as your sanctuary. God can be that for you. Alternatively, same verse 14, he can prove to be a stone of offense and a rock over which you stumble to your ruin. It's up to you, the prophet says to his Jewish listeners. But his words live on today and now for us, because the Apostle Peter in the New Testament picks up the quote from verse 14 and applies it to later generations in 1 Peter 2:8, the stone of stumbling. See, it's either ruin or revival. It's one or the other, kill or cure. Which is it to be? Where are you traveling to? Asks the prophet. And take care over the matter, urges the Bible. We do take care, you know, when we travel places. I do. I'm a very bad traveler. So when I know that I'm going to travel, as I did last year, I remember, from Ireland coming back to London, what do? I mean, I do everything I can. I set the alarm clock for an early breakfast. I get that vital lift into the airport, check in the right desk, asking anxiously all the way along which is the right desk, listening out carefully for that flight detail, heading purposefully towards gate 6, looking over the shoulder of the man in front of me just to make sure that he's got the same details on his pass. Then at the doors, I come out onto the tarmac. I'll even say to the official, is this the flight to London? Of course we do. We don't want to get lost and waste time. There are plenty of people, it's the amazement, plenty of people who drift through this world without giving even 10 minutes thought to their ultimate destination. What is it all for and where are you heading? Plenty of people, equipped, intellectuals, have they given even 10 minutes thought to it? Very often the answer is no. This is why we collect together on a Sunday. This is why we get together in those fellowship groups. Why? To remind each other, come on, what's it all about in the end? You as a person, us as a Christian family, where are we heading? What's it all for? Where's the destination? There was a group, both in Israel and Judah, gathered around the prophet Isaiah like a fellowship group that had given thought and preparation to their future destiny in their life with God. So we read in verses 17 and 18. Have a look at it, would you? Verse 17 and 18. I and the children whom the Lord has given me, is how Isaiah describes this minority remnant group. They alone would be preserved in their faith as God's people when everything familiar to them was rocking and taken away. The pathway of the two destinies is very, very clearly outlined in these last verses, 19 to the end. Have a look at it again, 19. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the wizards who chirp and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living, to the teaching and to the testimony? And you see the contrast here. Instead of prophets, mediums would be looked to for guidance. Instead of teaching, gibberish would be listened to. Instead of the living, the world of the dead would be attended to. It's no wonder that for those who took that path, there would be, end of verse 20, no dawn of hope. Verse 21, no fulfillment, no direction, no satisfaction whatever, but verse 22, only thick darkness. A tale of two identities, Meher Shalal Hashbaz or Emmanuel. On which will we stake our future? Asks Isaiah. A tale of two kingdoms. Which river will we entrust ourselves to? The gentle or the chaotic? A tale of two destinies. We can't just go nowhere, comes the message of this chapter and of the Bible. It's either to be judgment, or it's to be the one great fact of life. God with us. Emmanuel. Let's be still for a moment. Quiet. Responsive. Then we'll ask Chris Hobbs to lead us in a prayer of humility and confession.